Most of us learned a little poem in elementary school about how Christopher Columbus sailed the ocean blue in 1492, but little has been written about the other three trips to the New World that he took in 1493, 1498, and 1502. In his latest book, Columbus, The Four Voyages, biographer Lawrence Berggreen details the subsequent transatlantic crossings in addition to Columbus's famed voyage of discovery. It's published by Viking, and since we're about to start a new year, we thought we would replay that interview about the New World. I began by asking Mr. Berggreen, you make it clear that Europeans had underestimated the size of the world in Columbus's time, but hadn't the Greeks already figured out how large it was?
Yes, they had, using mathematics, but it was lost knowledge that was slowly becoming recovered during the Renaissance. But in Columbus's time, his conventional wisdom was there was no Pacific Ocean, so the circumference of the world was 10,000 miles less than it actually is.
Is it appropriate that your publisher is named Viking? Did the Vikings also think that the world was flat?
You know, I don't know about nobody thought it was flat who went to sea, because they could see masts and hulls slip below the horizon, and that included Columbus. What was out there once they got out of sight of land and of Europe was something else, and there were a lot of stories about sea monsters, but there were also stories about a shortcut to Asia, which was Christopher Columbus's great idea inspired by Marco Polo.
An article in the U.S. News and World Report claimed that Columbus was inspired by the Vikings. Do you see any truth in that?
Well, I haven't read anything that reveals that. He picked up the rumors and the studies that were around. He corresponded with several map makers and several clerics and learned from them. I haven't seen documentation about the Vikings in particular.
You've written a number of straight biographies on Louis Armstrong, Irving Berlin, Al Capone, James A.G., but your other books are largely about explorations. Mm-hmm. Does the one like the Marco Polo book lead to the next one?
Well, in this case, yes, because about 10 years ago, I wrote a book about NASA's exploration of Mars robotically. And the NASA scientists with whom I spent some time were constantly talking about and inspired by the explorers of the Age of Discovery, Columbus and Da Gama and Magellan and others. And eventually, it occurred to me, I got through my thick skull, that it might be interesting to write about the explorers themselves. So taking my lead from them, at first it was Magellan, and then that led back to Marco Polo, who inspired the whole thing, even though he went over land and it was 200 years earlier.
How did Columbus, a ship captain from Genoa, initially get the attention of Ferdinand and Isabella, the King and Queen of Spain?
Oh, that's an interesting story of persistence. Genoa, as a city-state, couldn't contain all the mariners within it. Columbus served his apprenticeship in the service of Genoa and then joined an expatriate Genoese colony of mariners, first in Portugal, where he spent 8 frustrating years trying to get King João of Portugal to back his voyage. Then, with other Genoese, moved to Spain and succeeded rather quickly in getting Ferdinand and Isabella to back him, partly because they sensed that the moment was coming and they wanted to be first.
But this is before Spain owned huge swaths of Italy.
Yes, Spain had just finished the Inquisition, or was just in the process of finishing it, and they were hanging together, I would say not by a thread, but the union of Ferdinand and Isabella, which was largely a political one, was designed to, in some sense, unify Spain.
The Inquisition was about 12 years in at this point. Was his voyage related in any way to the Inquisition?
I think indirectly. He left just as the Inquisition became the law of the land in certain ways in Spain, and it clearly had to do with an extension of the Empire of Castile, to name the most prominent, but not the only, Spanish empire. Columbus brought a number of conversos, that is, recent or forced converts to Christianity, on his ship, who served in various responsible positions, as did many of the court's ministers. So it was part of the political atmosphere in which he lived.
What did Ferdinand and Isabella hope to gain from this? This had to be a pretty expensive undertaking, as at a time when they're their country was in crisis.
Yes. Wealth. Oh, and incidentally, some conversions to put a good face on it. Columbus had read a copy of Marco Polo's travels, probably took it with him on at least one of the voyages, maybe more, and made detailed marginal notes, which we have copies of, about the things he could find, a shopping list, if you will, of gold, of spices, ominously, of slaves, and other things. And that was the bill of goods that he sold to Ferdinand and Isabella. Also said he would effect as many conversions to Christianity as possible. Columbus was, among other things, a deeply religious man.
Although there are people who claim that he was Jewish.
Yeah. In New York, they claim that he might really be Jewish, but there's no truth to that. In Portugal, where I've done research, the same with Portuguese, and in Brazil, Portuguese. There was an article in the Daily Mail in England not too long ago that claimed he was really Polish and that he was the illegitimate son of King Stanislaus. However, there's overwhelming documentation that he was really from Genoa.
What was his plan for crossing the ocean?
Well, his plan was, and keep in mind that he had the benefit of ignorance of the real size of the ocean, was that in a few weeks or a few days, he wasn't sure which, he would be able to arrive at the outskirts of Asia, India, China. They all meant approximately the same thing in those days, and begin trading relations with the Mongols, whom he had read about in Marco Polo, and even with Kublai Khan. Now, the Mongol Empire and Kublai Khan were long gone at this point. Somehow Columbus didn't realize that fact. Instead, of course, he bumped to, and we're not sure exactly where, somewhere in the Bahamas or the Windward Islands as his first landfall in the New World, and decided that he had arrived at his goal.
But hadn't he also made a stop over in the Canary Islands to meet with a woman?
Yes, he had a brief liaison with a woman there, and there's a lot of enticing rumors about this romance and the fact that he managed to sort of escape her clutches, if you will. A later liaison of hers wound up hanging from the rafters of her house, so I guess she could be a rather dangerous person to tangle with.
So he starts sailing across the Atlantic, and even today that is a long voyage with steamboats or we use nowadays.
Yes.
How long did the trip take?
Well, it's funny. You say long, but I think it was shorter than Columbus believed possible. It was only 3.5 weeks. And even today, sailors relying on sail power alone can't do it in much better time than that. So how did Columbus manage this? Well, partly it was luck. He discovered, and there's no hard evidence that he knew in advance, that the trades would carry him across the Atlantic. Once he got the hang of the trades, it was pretty much of a straight shot.
And I assume that affected his approach the subsequent trips.
Yes. He had managed to crack the code, if you will, of how to sail across the Atlantic to this misunderstood landmass lying on the other side. And he was the first one to do it. You have to step back for a second amid all the welter of controversy and horrible justified criticisms of Columbus to appreciate the fact that anybody else who had tried this before never returned.
Although he didn't get to the landmass, he got to islands.
That's right. He got to islands. Eventually he got on subsequent voyages, and even beginning with the first voyage to Cuba, and then he made his way to Venezuela, Central America, the coast of Nicaragua and Panama, as we now call them, and so did explore a lot of the Americas. By the way, he never glimpsed North America.
And so he's going to a rather warm climate.
Yes, which is what he was used to. And his main complaint about it in his copious logs, which I drew on and those of other participants in the voyage, was the terrible weather, the storms that lasted not for days but for weeks. And Columbus was, among other things, an extraordinarily skillful navigator, even if he was confused about geography. And even he had endless complaints about bad weather.
Had he arrived during the rainy season?
Yes, and he didn't understand how the rainy season worked in South America, and so the fact that it went on for not only weeks but months, and it was dreary, it was depressing, and you can feel the psychological depression that he felt in some of his highly emotional outbursts.
How is he received by the indigenous people?
Well, that's a very interesting, complicated story. At first, quite well, because the Taíno were the most prevalent people in the New World at that point, considered Columbus and his ships the fulfillment of a prophecy of theirs, as best we can piece together. And so they greeted him with open arms. But later, over the course of these four voyages, that turned to despair when they realized he wasn't going away. He was occupying their sacred lands, and his men were carrying on with their women, which was very upsetting to them.
Now, this is not the only prophecy that the Spaniards faced, the conquistadors faced in the New World. In the conquest of Mexico, there also was a similar prophecy. Do we have any idea why they assumed these gods would come from the East?
I don't know why that prophecy occurred, but Columbus apparently fulfilled it. After a while, though, the Taino realized this was, if anything, an anti-prophecy, and they protested in the strongest way possible with mass suicides.
Well, initially, they in his return to Europe, they helped him when the Santa Maria ran aground, didn't they?
Yes, they could be helpful from time to time, even in dire straits. Even when he began to enslave them in his obsessive search for gold, which was inspired by Ferdinand and Isabella, there were some Taino who were willing to be helpful and loyal to Columbus, to give him the benefit of a doubt, if you will.
My guest is Lawrence Bergreen. Lawrence spelt with a U, and Bergreen, B-E-R-G-R-E-E-N. His latest book, Columbus, The Four Voyages, published by Viking. When he returned to Spain, you say that he misrepresented his findings.
Yes, he was the great exaggerator and misrepresenter, partly because he didn't want other sea captains, sailors, to copy what he had done and steal his secrets. But that happened anyway within a few years. And partly because he wanted to impress on the fact to Ferdinand and Isabel that he had actually accomplished his mission, when, of course, he hadn't. So he built up everything into sort of preposterous
So he didn't bring back any gold. Well, there wasn't much gold.
He did bring back some gold. Mm-hmm. He brought back some fruit. He sent back, interestingly enough, at least one shipload of potential slaves of Taino and others who he thought would be good slaves. And Ferdinand and Isabella's reaction was very telling. They sent that ship back to the New World. They didn't want slaves, and it was not from humanitarian purposes. This is, after all, was the time of the Spanish Inquisition, but because they had just finished this wrenching Spanish Inquisition, and they did not want to bring another unknown type of outsider into their land. Columbus was puzzled by this decision. He had grown up in Genoa, as we talked about earlier, and slaves there were part of the fabric of life. Most families who could afford to have slaves had them, so this was a concept that Columbus was sadly enough familiar with.
But they sent him back.
They sent him back.
They financed him and they expanded his mission.
Yes, they sent him back partly because he manipulated them into doing it. He had stranded several dozen men in what we now call the New World and told them, as soon as he arrived at the end of his first voyage, that he had done so. And they said, oh, we've got to send him back again to save Spain's honor and to save these valiant men's lives. In fact, by the time he did return, they had all been killed. The circumstances are still in doubt, but there was some sort of massacre that occurred.
When did he realize that the land he had gotten to was not India or China?
Never consciously. There was a moment when many of the pilots and experienced sailors around him realized that the island of Cuba was in fact an island, and they heard that from the Indians who lived on Cuba as well. If Columbus admitted that, it meant that his whole concept of world geography and the concept of the voyage was in doubt, and so he signed them all to an oath, swearing that Cuba was part of this mythical Asian mainland, and that even included ship's boys, young children who would come along. Anybody who violated the oath was punished with 75 lashes, which could be fatal. Now, even his skilled mapmaker, Wanda Lacoza, knowing better, signed this oath, although shortly after he got back to Spain, he did make a map showing that Cuba was an island.
Didn't he stay in the New World for an extended period of time?
Yes, he spent... more time on land in the New World, in the Dominican Republic, especially on the island of Hispaniola.
Yes.
And in the city of Santo Domingo, which he founded, than he did on water or in Spain during this 10-year period.
And during the 10 years, other ships started coming over from Spain.
Other ships
started.
Some were part of his fleet. Some were competitors whom Ferdinand Isabella started sending after they had had enough with Columbus. And what was tragic from everybody's point of view, that Columbus was forced to abandon his main skill, which was sailing and navigation, and become an administrator of this fledgling colony. And he was terrible at it. There was nobody around him who seemed to be any better. Ferdinand Isabella belatedly sent a rigid bureaucrat, Nicolas de Ovando, to replace him. He was no better than Columbus. He carried out the same policies. So Columbus was actually forced to do something that he was not planned to do and had no particular experience doing, which was to manage a colony. Very different from sailing.
Now, did he realize that each time he was landing in a different place?
Yes, he did. He knew that, and he kept maps of his travels, although there's some suspicion that he actually distorted where he went, again, to throw potential copycats off the scent, off his track. But he realized he was going to a different place. He just kept thinking if he just could get far enough, sail far enough west, he would reach the east. Of course, it never happened.
You say the fourth of his voyages is wild.
In my opinion, that was the most interesting. By then, he was sailing on his own recognizance. He had been more or less fired or replaced by Ferdinand Isabella. He had put together a relatively small expedition. He brought his teenage son with him, Ferdinand, who later on wrote, I thought, quite movingly about his father, Christopher Columbus, and what it was like on this voyage. They were shipwrecked for almost a year in Dry Harbor, Jamaica, and barely managed to stave off the Indians, and I believe they were Taino there, who were threatening to kill them. He only managed to escape by successfully predicting a lunar eclipse when the moon turns red, which had the effect of terrifying the Indians, who then gave him a wide berth after that.
The Taino don't exist anymore.
They're practically gone. There is some effort now to revive or preserve Taino culture, but as a separate ethnic identity, they have merged into larger populations.
Yours is one of four Columbus biographies to be released this year. Why do you think it's this year? I remember 1992 made real sense.
Yes. There are a number of books that touch on this. It's a very rich subject. I think each of these books comes at it from a different angle. I'm talking about the voyages. Others are talking about some of the effects. He is still at the fulcrum of history, and even though he wasn't the first, he changed so many things in human history and in the natural world that we keep going back to reevaluate what he was like and what he actually did or didn't do.
Well, the first voyage was three ships, the Nina, the Pinta,
yes,
and the Santa Maria. Mm-hmm. Were they the same ships that he sailed in on the other voyages?
No, he eventually expanded the fleet to 17 ships and even more after that. And then supply ships came during his extended stays on the island of Hispaniola.
And you even list the supplies that he had and the supplies that his men had. It was very interesting to see the class distinctions here.
Yes, there was a wish list, and they were rather Spartan provisions for the ordinary sailors and seamen, and then you could see how Columbus saw himself as entitled to a more luxurious living in the New World with the items that he was sending. But he didn't get them, by the way, and these items were dismissed. But he never starved. There was abundant food and water and other items for living in the New World.
Did he die?
He made it back to Spain at the end of the fourth voyage, died at a monastery shortly after his main sponsor, Queen Isabella, died.
And was he celebrated at the time?
Well, you know, he was widely condemned and criticized and controversial right from the beginning, from the first voyage. So at that time, I think there might have been a sense of relief that Columbus was gone. Certainly his imitators were happy to keep capitalizing on his discoveries. Not till the 19th century was any kind of romantic notion of Columbus finally floated.
And not everywhere. In 1992 in Mexico, there were many people who refused to celebrate
the
anniversary. The book, Columbus, The Four Voyages, is published by Viking. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.